Ars Electronica 2008. A new cultural economy.
Ja. Während vorne noch aufgebaut wird, nehme ich die Zeit, um Frau Paul schon einmal vorzustellen. Ich mache das auf Englisch, weil Christiane Paul eins von diesen globalisierten Mischwesen ist, die man eigentlich gar nicht mehr wirklich auf eine Nationalität festlegen kann. Und da sie auf Englisch sprechen wird, dachte ich, ich führe sie auch auf Englisch ein. Christiane Paul ist Adjunct Curator of New Media Arts at the Whitney Museum of American Art and Director of Intelligent Agent, a service organization dedicated to digital art. And Christiane Paul really is a curator because, as she told me yesterday, actually she's curating like 4 exhibitions at the same time in different continents. So she's really traveling like the whole year to curate exhibitions on contemporary arts and media arts. And at the same time, she also teaches in various computer arts departments. So at the School of Visual Arts in New York, at the Digital Plus Media Department of the Rhode Island School of Design, and at the San Francisco Art Institute, and at the University of California at Berkeley. So we are very happy to have her here, that we fitted into her schedule somehow, even if she told me that we are just at the beginning of the American semester, so it's probably not the best time of the year for her. And I wanted just to point to 2 things. Concerning curating shows, there was one show that I think might be very interesting also for the discussion here, which is a show entitled Feedback that she curated in Spain last year at the Laboral Center, because we could maybe discuss afterwards how the notion of feedback relates to our topic. And concerning publications, I would like to point out just one thing, because her interesting survey of digital art has just been published in a second expanded version, so that might be interested for the public. Christiane, I'm looking forward to your talk.
Thank you very much, Katja. Thanks for coming, and thanks to the Ludwig Boltzmann Institute for inviting me. I'm going to talk about interaction models in media art, that is new media art. Unfortunately, the time frame is too short to make it a broader presentation. And I will talk about it particularly with regard to ideas of virtuality and embodiment, which is a layer I'm going to impose here later. First of all, I want to basically pick up where Katja left off, or again go back to some of her ideas here and summarize them as a background. The basic quote and definition of interaction for the purpose of this symposium that Katja mentioned was the relation between 2 or more relatively independent things or systems, and this is coming from the Dictionary of Philosophy and Psychology. When I looked up other definitions on the internet, more or less randomly, there seemed to be more of a shift to human-computer interaction, and Katja already mentioned 3 of the basic definitions, from social psychology to cybernetics, the more feedback-oriented idea of interaction and the human-computer interface. So if you look at the definitions up on the screen, you see an increasing shift to the exchange of information between a computer and the person using it, or interactive television systems that can be slightly absurdly here, used by families for two-way cable television. I'm not exactly sure where that is coming from. But you see a little bit of a shift to the HCI definition here. And I want to connect this briefly to an idea, an essay by Florian Kramer, what is interface aesthetics and what could it be not? I think we could all, oops. For some reason, my presentation crashed. I think we would all agree that interaction can happen only through interfaces. And the interface obviously is the in-between, the surface forming a boundary between bodies, spaces, or phases. In his essay, What is Interface Aesthetics and What Could It Be Not?, Florian Kramer outlines six different forms of interfaces, from hardware to hardware, to humans to software. If you look at this list, software to hardware, for example, would be operating system kernels and drivers, or software to software would be APIs or plug-in interfaces. And Florian comes to the conclusion that out of these six possible interfaces, media studies tends to privilege, if not limit itself, to the latter. And he calls this the restrained interface. Looking at interaction, I think one could also make a claim that in the interpretation of interaction, we're very often looking at restrained interaction, that is a focus on the human-computer interaction. I do not want to propose here that interaction should be seen predominantly from a strictly instrumental and technological point of view, but at the same time, I think it's important and good to remember that all of these interfaces, hardware to software, APIs, kernels, are programmed by humans with a specific agenda. The interactions we have with art systems in the narrow and in the broad sense are to some extent defined by the interfaces that humans have created with a specific agenda in mind. And I think that any study of interactivity has to consider this. I want to go over a few diagrams which I'm borrowing from Beryl Graham's PhD thesis, which focuses on interaction, but predominantly interaction with interactive art in museums, which is not the topic of my presentation here, but her diagrams of taxonomies are actually pretty helpful for our discussion, and Katja has already mentioned some of them. One of the diagrams is from Popper, 1975, and I'm using this just as a reminder that, as Katja has pointed out, interactivity is not bound to technological art, but the idea of participation starts much earlier. You could say that any artwork is interactive in the sense that the viewer is ultimately completing it. But of course, interactivity changes if the user, viewer, participant actually changes the work in the process. Popper makes a basic distinction here between conceptual, political, and kinetic art, and traces different forms. I think you could argue with his schema on various levels, but specifically when it comes to spectator participation, which he has only in the on the lower level of political art, basically, where he lists art in the street and actions and poster art and graffiti. And of course, this spectator participation is also an inherent part of technological art. I think it's very important that Beryl Graham here contrasts this with postmodernism and certain ideas of postmodernism, namely the politics of representation, a focus on the other and making visible the other, which has consequences such as the death of the author, reader response theory, the idea that the reader or viewer of art completes the work. And in her scheme here, this leads to interventions in mass media by any media necessary, and again into this idea of the democratization of art. And I will talk about that a little bit later, because I also think that this claim of democratization has to be further examined or can be problematic. Coming back to some of the ideas Katja has mentioned already, this is another diagram from Beryl's PhD thesis, and I'm zooming in here. Roy Ascott in the 60s already made a distinction between deterministic art, works that are conceived and realized by the artist, versus behavioral art, works that are only realized through active participation of the user. And Katja mentioned Cornock and Edmunds' scheme here, which distinguishes various dynamic art systems from interactive to participatory, reciprocal. I have a little bit of a problem with this distinction because when I try to apply it to art, I immediately can come up with artworks that are both within this schema or taxonomy interactive in the sense that there is mutual exchange between man and machine, and at the same time it's a participatory art system. There are interpersonal reactions of a group. So using specific artworks as an example, these categories begin to merge. And another system that Beryl Gray mentions here is by Steve Bell from 1991, which makes a distinction between other art, which is problematic, I think, and participatory one, and he distinguishes different degrees and manners of control. As Katja has already said, and as she outlines in her essay, Interactivity, a Word in Process, there are very different angles you can apply to the notion of interactivity. You can make distinctions between the ideological and instrumental views, and Dieter Daniels has also pointed out that interactivity always is an ideology and a technology, but we also have to think about epistemological concepts, the insights and forms of knowledge that are unveiled or promoted by interactive art, and aesthetic issues, be they internal, meaning within the artwork itself, or receptional. I want to briefly return to Myron Kruger's essay, Responsive Environments, and the conclusions he drew from the GloFlow project that Katja described. Kruger was one of the first people to really make a case for response as a medium. He pointed out that the purpose of technology is not only to solve problems, that it also creates concepts and philosophy, and that the next generation of technology will speak to us, understand us, and perceive our behavior. Among the conclusions that he drew from the experience of the GloFlow environment was not only that computers should perceive their environment, the participants' behavior, and react to it, but one very important final conclusion, the only aesthetic concern is the quality of the interaction. The visual responses should not be judged as art, nor the sounds as music. I find this pretty radical and problematic. I think that visuals still play a role, and sound and music do in their aesthetics. But a very important aspect here is the quality of interaction. And I think, from my experience, at least the art world at large still ignores that aspect of interactive art a bit too much. The medium of response and the quality of the interaction that is enabled by a work. So I want to connect this a little bit more to issues of the body and embodiment by using artworks as examples. First of all, what I mean by embodiment is the difference between the enacted body present in the flesh here within this room and on one side of the computer screen versus the represented body, let's say the avatar in a virtual environment. And I also will bring that back to social concerns later. To introduce this, I want to start with yet another schema of interaction in terms of degrees of openness. Now, this taxonomy applies to single users, multiple users, or automata, whatever is interacting here. And degrees of openness of these systems also directly relate to issues of agency of the viewer and the possibilities that a participant has to reconfigure or change the system. So one first level would be the navigation of a pre-configured system such as a database. So basically you are picking paths through a project that ultimately is informationally closed because you're always dealing with the same elements, you're reshuffling the deck. Another degree of openness would be frameworks that invite audience contribution or participation. As an example, I would use Andy Deck's Open Studio, an online drawing board where people can draw together. And I think that Kruger's ideas about response as the medium are incredibly important when it comes to a project like this. The drawings may not be that interesting. What is interesting is how people react to each other within this environment. This category would also refer to Web 2.0 and virtual worlds, and I want to talk about that a little bit later. Another form of interaction and degree of openness would be enabled by data visualizations and filters for ongoing processes, such as large-scale conversations, for example. Examples of projects here would be Warren Sacks' Conversation Map, which basically analyzes large-scale online conversations in terms of the social networks they're forming, the semantic networks, and how the message threads are developing, or his project Agonistics, a language game which uses the science of agonistics, which is the science of combat, as a starting point for analyzing online conversations, and participants here are structured in a circle depending on whether their arguments are opposed to each other. The person making the most arguments appears in the middle as dominating the conversation. The point here being, people may not interact with these visualizations themselves, but they are participating by taking part in a conversation. The visualization here is a filter that is imposed onto it. So it's a very different kind of interaction that takes place here, but if you participate in a conversation on an email list, let's say Rhizome, while having agonistics running, your interaction with people and your posting of messages changes. If I would post to this conversation, in all likelihood, I would be aware of the fact that, oh, Kurt is dominating this conversation, making the most posts, and I would realize whom I find myself opposed to within an argument. Yet another category here would be generative projects, and I mean generative in the broadest sense of the word. This could be a work such as projects by Casey Rias, where basically a visual formal process is set in motion. This could relate to artificial life or intelligence projects. Ken Feingold's That Sinking Feeling, where you basically have a conversation with a head sitting in a flower pot, which reads your conversation and responds to you, would be one example of that. And that already leads into the idea of automata or system interaction, which is something that tends to be neglected, I think. As an example of system interaction, I would mention Maji Wisniewski's Instant Places. Here, people are not actively participating in a system, but you have autonomous software creatures or agents that live on different servers around the world. So in this case, you have eagles and mice living on servers, let's say at the ZKM in Karlsruhe or in Tokyo. Well, you as a viewer only see them within the exhibition space. If you look at the screen they are appearing on, they are floating amongst servers around the world. So a hawk in Tokyo might see a mouse in Karlsruhe and dive down and snap it from the ground. So what we have here is system interaction within a global network of which we as viewers only see a little glimpse on a screen. And I think this is a very actually beautiful way of making the network or the lack of accessibility to the network or viewing it obvious to viewers and participants. And the last category would be systems and frameworks that can be reconfigured by the participants. And here I really mean open source software, game engines, the hacking of game engines, where users, participants, interactors really change the system itself rather than navigating within a pre-configured system. And again, I want to connect this a little bit to embodiment and how our bodies or virtual selves interact with these different systems. First of all, again, in terms of embodiment, I mean the enacted versus the represented body. And I think Catherine Hales, in her prologue to how we became post-human, virtual bodies in cybernetics literature and informatics, made a very important point by naming the Turing test as a key moment in the reconfiguration of embodiment. What is at the heart of the Turing test, you might say, or she proposes, is the erasure of embodiment, because within Turing's system, intelligence becomes a property that is determined by formal manipulations of symbols, and that is not enacted by the body anymore. How dubious that may be is another question. I think you can approach it from various angles. But I want to make that a background of this discussion of embodiment. I'm using art projects as examples that I assume you are all familiar with. You may not be familiar with all of them, but I don't want to go into the projects themselves and just use them as examples. So there is a whole basically field of so-called reactive art where the body becomes a kind of interface. Examples would be Camille Utterback's Text Rain, where you're basically bouncing text off your body. The shadow or silhouette of your body is being read and allows for the interaction. At the same time, the project itself is a pre-configured database, more or less. The elements within it do not change, they're reshuffled. Similarly, Scott Snibbe's Visceral Cinema projects, this is a scene from Chien Andalou, follow an equal interaction model. You are, as a viewer, embedded in the narrative, and moving your body will influence it. You might help the man pushing the piano forward, or you can actually dissolve his body into ants. In any case, your body becomes part of the scene, and you are seemingly influencing it, while at the same time you're reshuffling the deck of a database. In Char Davies' virtual reality projects, Osmos and Ephemere, which are classics of the virtual reality genre, you are navigating the environment with a headset, and at the same time you are wearing a vest that monitors your breathing. So here the bodily interaction is taken to a different level. You're floating through the environment and you're controlling it to some extent through breathing and moving your body around. Screen by Noah Waldrip Fruin and a team of collaborators offers an interesting take on bodily interactions, in that in the middle of the piece you have a paradigm shift occurring. This is a piece created for a cave environment, and when you as a viewer, user, participant stand inside of it, you're first presented with three texts. These texts are appearing on the walls around you, they are read to you, you have absolutely no influence on it. It is a classic reading paradigm without any interaction. Then the words begin to peel off the walls, and with your hand you can throw them back, snap them into places. The whole project is a reflection on memory and how memories come apart, construct our identity. I don't want to get too deeply into the project, but I think the interesting aspect of interaction here is that you have a complete switch of interaction paradigm in the middle of it, where you turn from a passive viewer into an interactor who seemingly has control over the environment. And very often in projects, this is a simulation of control. At the same time, I think it's important to take a note of this. Another very important project when it comes to issues of control was Art Plus Com's Cesea, or D-Viewer, where basically through looking at a painting, you would destroy it. The project does eye tracking and then dissolves the pixels of the painting in front of your eyes. So in this case, seemingly the viewer participant has complete control over the artwork and destroys it. Of course, it's not complete control because your action is restricted to just that process. But when it comes to embodiment and control and agency, I think this project makes an important point, and people found it incredibly upsetting at the time in 1992 when it was first presented. Very different form of interaction, participation, and control occurs in SWEN, the surveillance video entertainment network created by Amy Alexander and collaborators, which I showed at the Whitney Museum last year. In this case, this is not a shot from the Whitney, which I show later. In this project, you have a camera placed somewhere on the street or in the museum. We had it hidden under a staircase. And what the system does is basically perform profiling, surveillance tracking of the body in this space. So this is actual software that is being used for profiling, but in this case it tries to determine whether you have the potential to be a rock star or not. And it compares your body, your clothing to videos and then inserts you into, let's say, a Nirvana video based on how you move through the space and whether there are similarities between your body movement or posture of your head and Kurt Cobain's. So this was actually a shot from the installation at the Whitney. What is interesting here is that people are participants in this project. The project would not be possible without the participants. At the same time, they may not be aware at all of being profiled, of being surveyed, and basically having an evaluation of their body language done. So the control paradigm here is reversed. You still have a lot of embodied participation within this project. At the same time, you may not even be aware of it. Yet another category would be the technologized connectivity between bodies through the mobile devices we are carrying with ourselves. This as an example is Jonah Brooker Cohen's and Catherine Moriwaki's umbrella.net, a spontaneous network that is being created if you find yourself caught in rain. Your umbrellas are equipped with Bluetooth and you create an ad hoc network with all the people opening their umbrellas at the same point. It's a very simple proposition, but what it shows is basically the circumstantial connection between bodies in this system. And I want to switch to the, briefly at least, to the avatar as a virtual form of embodiment. So here we have the represented self on the screen. And what distinguishes this, of course, is that in addition to your enacted body, you have the represented body that returns the gaze looking back at you. The images you see here are snapshots from performances that Eva and Franco Mattes from 01001, etc., have done, and they make a very good example because they are reenactments of very physical performances. On the top left, you have the reenactment of Marina Abramović's and Ulay's Imponderabilia, and in the actual projects, you had the naked bodies of the performers in the doorframe, and you had to make a decision about would you pass through the door? If so, would you turn towards the naked man or the naked woman? All of which loses its connotation within a virtual system where you're basically navigating your avatar between the bodies. So the quality here radically changes. Same goes for Chris Burden's shoot. There is no real bullet. There are no real wounds in this project. And what does that mean for representation and for the project itself? These issues have been much discussed, particularly the idea of agency and autonomy in virtual environments such as Second Life, where these performances take place. I did a project with Simon Golden and Jacob Sanaby for the Artport website at the Whitney, where they, over the course of a month, created a magazine in Second Life. And basically, people would contribute essays and remarks online in a wiki, and then editorial meetings were held in Second Life. What you're seeing here on the screen are screenshots from the editorial meetings. The magazine was called Flag Attack on Autonomy, and the whole discussion was very much about social structures within these virtual worlds, what they mean for the representation of the body of social structure. And as you can see here, you know, some people considered Second Life a game of alienating social structure. There were issues concerning institutionalized behavior within these environments, or issues surrounding government movement, self-government within the environment. And this is also something that has been much discussed with regard to massive multiplayer online games, such as World of Warcraft, where town hall meetings are being held, and where you have very interesting forms of self-government emerging. And to close within a few minutes, I want to connect this more to ideas of social structures and Web 2.0 environments. As Dieter has already pointed out, particularly within the theme of this year's Ars Electronica, new forms of interactivity and participation have been emerging through Web 2.0 social networking services such as Flickr, YouTube, Facebook, and others. The definition you have up here is, of course, the corporate definition by O'Reilly Media, where Tim O'Reilly declared this to be a business revolution caused by the move to the internet as a platform. Wow, who would have thought that the internet could be a platform? It always has been since its inception. And the attempt to understand the rules for success on that new platform, I would argue that every critic of new media or media arts has been engaged in that process for a long time. What is interesting here is, of course, that while people have all these wonderful possibilities of connecting and participating, at the same time they enhance corporate capital. They're contributing to a corporate framework, and if you check what rights you have, you basically giving up all of your rights to the corporations owning this. Tiziana Terranova and others have been writing about this idea of free labor and producing culture for the digital economy, and Terranova in particular writes about the net slaves, which constitute a new form of capitalism or complex relation to labor, in that people are happily building websites, modifying software packages, and reading and participating in mailing lists. Ultimately, all activities that are considered creative production and self-realization, but at the same time they enhance a new form of capitalist emphasis on knowledge as the main source of value added. This, of course, being a Marxist, post-Marxist critique of this system. But artists have also been picking up on this and playing with this concept. Aaron Koeblin, in his project The Sheep Market, did this explicitly. This was his final project, his MFA thesis actually at UCLA. And it consisted of a very simple website where participants were asked to draw a sheep left to right. Using Amazon's Mechanical Turk software, every worker was paid 2 cents to draw a sheep. So here you have the statistics, the average wage that people received, and the collection period at the website. You have animations of all the drawings. And then he also sells blocks of these sheep as stamps for $20. People were shocked when they discovered this, and there was a huge discussion surrounding the project, which I consider an intrinsic part of it, where people raised all these questions about their labor, their wage, being sold by the artist, ultimately, and what that meant for social and cultural production. And I want to end here with a website or a project that directly comments on Tiziana Terranova's theories. User Labour by Burak Avrican and Engin Erdogan, which is a framework for sustaining user labour across the web. And what they came up with was the user labour markup language, ULML, which basically allows you to monitor the contributions you make to social networking sites such as YouTube and Flickr. So basically, this variation of XML, HTML would allow you to look at how many images have I uploaded, how much tagging have I done, how have I enhanced the cultural product within this environment. So while I want to end it here, and I certainly do not have enough time to get into all of these issues in depth, but this presentation was meant to basically throw different lenses or a flashlight on different aspects of how virtuality and embodiment play out with regard to different models of interaction, and I'm sure we can discuss that further later on. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Christiane. Vielen Dank, Christiane. Ich mache jetzt mal auf Deutsch weiter, weil du, glaube ich, gesagt hast, du nimmst ohnehin Fragen in Deutsch und Englisch an. Ist es genau?
Hm? Here or
yeah, whatever you prefer. Okay. Maybe you. Ja, also es war wirklich, fand ich, ein toller Bogen nochmal gespannt von den Beginn-Definitionen von Interaktion bis zur aktuellen Web 2.0-Thematik, die ja auch dann wieder zu unserem zu dem ganzen Framework der ARS eine Verbindung zieht. Ich würde aber, da wir eben extra auch viel Zeit für Diskussionen gelassen haben, auch direkt das Publikum einladen, Fragen zu stellen und mich hier gar nicht so herauslehnen wollen, wenn es direkt Fragen gibt vom Publikum. Gut, dann muss ich wohl erstmal die Eisbrecherfrage stellen. Ja, also ich fand zwei Dinge eigentlich besonders, oder drei Dinge besonders spannend jetzt am Schluss. Da werden wir sicher auch noch drauf zurückkommen, haben wir gestern auch mit Susanne schon diskutiert, nämlich die verschiedenen Rollen, die Künstler und Benutzer einnehmen in solchen Kunstprozessen, die sich eben auch durch sowas wie diese Schieb-Geschichte nochmal verändern eigentlich oder auch reflektiert werden. Aber ich denke, da können wir vielleicht auch dann bei Susannes Vorstellung vielleicht nochmal drauf zurückkommen. Was ich hier vielleicht, um auch so von der Basis der Definitionen auszugehen, gerne nochmal diskutieren würde, ist diese Frage der Degrees of Interactivity oder Scales of Interactivity. Wie du dazu stehst, findest du, ist es ein nützliches Modell für die interaktive Kunst, so verschiedene Grade an niedriger oder starker Interaktion beziehungsweise niedriger oder starker Offenheit aufzumachen? Oder siehst du das in der Kunst eher als schwierig an?
I think it's very difficult to basically categorize these forms of or degrees of openness or interaction, but I think it's crucial to understanding interaction and what it really is. You know, at a certain point, every corporation or every little company would declare their website to be fully interactive, meaning you could click on a link and get to the next page. I mean, what user interaction do we have here? When it comes to artwork, I think response as a medium and the aesthetics of response and agency within a project are incredibly important. What I do not want to say is that the more the artwork is open, the better it is. That is certainly not a degree of quality I would use here. But in terms of understanding reception and response as a medium, I think it's incredibly important to pay attention to the degrees of openness of the system and the agency the viewer has. And sometimes it can actually be, as I have learned from many ARS juries, a problem in terms of the success of an artwork. If an artwork could have been much more open, could have given the audience much more agency and involvement while deliberately limiting it or being informationally closed, I think that becomes an issue for the success of a project. Personally, I find degrees of openness and agency very important in assessing interaction in general, or the success of it. And that goes down to a very experiential level, even without reflecting too much onto it. When I experience an artwork, or I think when people experience an artwork, this experience and their reception of it is very much affected by this idea of agency and control and the involvement they have within an environment, or investment. I mean, investment into a work is, of course, connected to possibilities of agency.
And would you say that degrees of openness are the same as degrees of interactivity? So is it also most interactive when it's most open? So would like the face-to-face paradigm be the most the most possible interactive?
I think you could do that. You could certainly do that, you know, and say that openness directly relates to degrees of interactivity. I'm not saying that there couldn't be other models, you know, and that you could, for example, connect it to a more epistemological model of that.
There is a question behind you.
Oh, great, thank you. Hello, I just wanted to then insert another word into perhaps the discourse at the moment, which is ethics. Mm-hmm. Because it strikes me that when you're talking, what you consider mm-hmm. to be important to define is actually ethical choices. So that the author of the work can't just consider these forms of kind of openness, interaction, agency, reception as just merely a kind of technical process, mm-hmm. because they're value laden. Mm-hmm. So one of the questions you're talking about when you look at the effectivity, mm-hmm. it's not just about measuring numerically degrees of, it's not to do with height, depth, mm-hmm. width.
Yeah.
It's actually a question about ethics.
Yeah.
Why is this process important? And I'm not sure that actually many artists are fully understanding that the medium they're engaged in is a lot to do with ethics. Actually, ethics is a medium. Mm-hmm. It's whereas, in fact, I think the history of interactive art has been very much about technical processes mm-hmm. as themselves being per se good, mm-hmm. which in a sense is the business model. It's valueless, except for we know it's not, mm-hmm. but it's presented as being valueless. Mm-hmm. It's just per se good that we can now do these things without analyzing what the ethical purpose of it is.
Well, I think you make a very important point, and ethics is very much connected to this, as is affect, you know. And again, I want to be very clear about the fact that you can use a lot of approaches here, from the technological one to affect, which is very much connected to agency and control, I would think, and ethics. There are many artists who are very much thinking about ethics, and I think, why is it important? Because it's also part of life. It's our interaction with the world. Why wouldn't it be part of interactive art? And ethics also very much comes into play when it comes to databases of any kind, social or more aesthetically oriented. As an artist, you make a choice about what to include, as the world makes choices about what to include in databases, which has a direct effect on politics, on the environment. There are a lot of ethical choices involved into that. Natalie Jeremijenko, for example, is an artist who always has paid a lot of attention to ethics within that context. I don't think that ethics is important to any interactive art project. There are, again, degrees of the importance of ethics, depending on what the work is. But the more open it is, the more interaction participation that takes place within the work, the more ethics becomes a very important factor.
Ich würde gern dort mit einer Frage nochmal anschließen. Ich spreche Deutsch. Du sprachst von Qualities of Interaction. Myron Krüger und sagt, es wäre sinnvoll, diese Qualities nochmal stärker in den Blick zu nehmen. Für Qualität brauchen wir Kriterien. Mich interessieren die Kriterien aber gar nicht so sehr, weil ich Kriterien nur anlegen kann im Hinblick auf eine Funktions- oder Nutzungsbestimmung mhm. oder eine Zielbestimmung. Jetzt wäre die Frage, und das schließt ein bisschen an das an, was meine Vorrednerin sagte, in Bezug nur auf interaktive Kunst, nicht auf Interaktion allgemein, in Bezug auf interaktive Kunst, was sind die Funktionen von Interaktivität? Wenn es nicht, das will ich mal ausschließen, die Thematisierung, die kritische Thematisierung von Interaktivität per se ist. Mhm. Was ist also sozusagen der Mehrwert, der Nutzen, die Funktionsbestimmung von Interaktivität im Sinne von Potenzial, wie Katja das aufgemacht hat, bei interaktiver Kunst? Also das Kunst unterstreiche ich in dem Fall.
So one thing about your question that is very, that makes it a great question and it's very problematic for art, do we actually want to approach art by saying what's the use function of it? You know, just imagine looking at a Picasso or any painting asking that question, you know, what's the function, what's the use function of this? I mean, I think every art historian would be absolutely horrified, as would be most curators by that question. And it's interesting that it is important to ask, and at the same time, I do not want to evaluate art or the aesthetics of art by talking about that criterion per se. Perhaps it's just a matter of reformulating it a little bit or looking at it from a slightly different perspective. I think every artist makes choices about the function and the use function of their work, but it may be very aesthetically oriented. I don't think there's one answer to this question or there is a silver bullet, because it varies so much from work to work. There may be some works that actually do want to comment on interactivity per se and reception and what it means. Others really want to give you new forms of visual experience, or let's say when it comes to more formal works like the ones by Casey Rios, it's really a reconsideration of form, of drawing, of the line, of painting, and what that means in a generative project. So in that case, I would make that the main function of use. So I think it's very important to ask that question, but within an art context, an art historical context, you're also walking a very, very fine line in terms of what that means for art or good art or successful art. I would, again, not make it a criterion for evaluation in terms of what is good art or bad art.
I actually think it is a tricky territory, and one I'm particularly interested in. I think that we'll find that you find that people that are interested in my area, which is more of a kind of a public process-based work, the questions of ethics are quite critical. And I think that one of the things that you, while you can't use it solely as a measure of the work, it gets very problematic to do that. You can use it as a useful measuring stick to look at the artist's intention and the artist's impact. And when you begin to make an intention politically with your work, you're almost thrust into that arena.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would absolutely agree with that.
Anybody else in the public who would like to ask a question? Maybe then just one more point from my side. What I also think are two very important notions that you also mentioned already in your title, it's the virtual and embodiment, or virtualities and embodiment. And the examples you showed us, from my impression, somehow still adhered to a very classical notion of virtuality, which is like the digital virtual, like the immersion, the immersive virtual. And I have the impression that at the moment, also with the theories of Masumi, who is naming the virtual more as the potential, as opposed not so much to the real, but to the actual, so what could be done. So I have the impression that somehow now, also within the digital arts, the notion of virtual changes towards embodiment. So I would like to ask, how do you see this relation between virtuality and embodiment?
I think that was part of my point. This tension between virtuality and embodiment has been at the core of the discourse of new media art for at least the past 10 years. So in the beginning, I think we had more talk about the immaterial, the virtual, it's all ephemeral. And then there was an increasing shift, or perhaps the discussion in other disciplines such as performance was more focused on the body and embodiment in the first place. But books such as Mark Hansen's Bodies in Code, you know, came later in the process. There always have been these poles. And I think that it's actually very hard to distinguish the two. They overlap in so many ways, and these overlapping zones are, to me, what is of most interest, and I think this is where the discussion is going. What you mentioned as a definition of virtual in terms of potential, I would think of that as the older definition. That is when Moholy Nagy used the word virtual. What he meant was ultimately that. So the I think the original use of the word virtual is closer to this potential than the purely digital use of it. But I mean, Virilio has pointed out that there is no such thing as a virtuality that does not have an impact on real life. I mean, you can talk about the data body that you are, your data being entered in so many databases, but they are used for making politics. They are used for making rules and guidelines that affect our lives on a daily basis. So you have direct overlap. When it comes, a very interesting example coming back to virtual worlds, I thought was Eve Online. I don't know if you're familiar with the game. And it's about basically sci-fi, different worlds. And part of a galaxy actually criticized the game developers and company for supposedly having rigged the game in favor of a galaxy where programmers of the company worked. And the management, the CEOs of the company said, "We consider ourselves a world. We take this very seriously." So they appointed a committee of people. They flew into Iceland, they were based in Iceland, you know, to basically have the committee evaluate forms of government and have independent oversight. So here you have, from an online world that creates countries and governments, an impact on the software company creating the game. I'm just using this as an example or almost metaphor, but these overlaps continuously happen, and I don't think that you can say virtuality is one thing, embodiment another. You constantly have these crossovers.
Yeah, and I think this is also very interesting to survey these crossovers during the day-to-day, because it also relates not only to the interactive arts, but of course also to the media society. So how's the relation between these kinds of face-to-face embodied interaction and mediated interaction? So that's why I also wanted to point on this, maybe to keep this in mind. Okay, thank you very much, Christiane, for your talk.
Thank you.